We're now going to lay down on tape the last installment of tonight's archive program concerning, well, this installment of the CIA-SNL connection. And we're going to be continuing in weeks to come because Harry Martin of the Napa Sentinel is now doing a series on intersections between the drug thug Len Vest case and the CIA-SNL connection. We're going to look at some of those connections this evening and then next week and in weeks to come as Harry Martin unravels this particular tangle of events up in Napa. We are going to relate that to you and present the information and enter it into the archives as it comes to light. Now, recall the relationship between the failure of the Centennial Savings and Loan and the milieu, the organized crime and intelligence milieu that we're looking at this evening. The key names so far in this particular connection, Mario Renda, who was one of the key people involved in the growth of Irv Hansen and Sid Shaw's Centennial Savings and Loan. Sid Shaw we're going to come to in weeks to come. Irv Hansen is one of the main foci of the broadcast this evening. And recall that Peter Robinson, the assistant U.S. attorney who was in charge with investigating and prosecuting the key people, investigating the Centennial scam and prosecuting the people involved, he focused the entire investigation on sweating out Irv Hansen, who then, was sweated out so thoroughly that he died under rather strange circumstances, thereby shunting aside many of the key aspects of the Centennial investigation. And we're going to go into all of this in greater length in weeks to come if some of this seems a little too abbreviated for listeners' tastes under the circumstance. Again, due to the length of the broadcast this evening, due to the complex tangle of events and names, I'm not going into all of this as completely as I might. I personally find it confusing enough as is. Now, bear in mind that Peter Robinson, who was initially investigating Centennial, wound up switching sides, in effect, at least to a certain extent. He began defending a lot of the same interests that he previously had been in charge with prosecuting or allegedly prosecuting, and in at least one instance, he apparently did not wait the required 2 years after retirement before beginning to defend him. Bear in mind also that Peter Robinson moved into offices. He moved into the former offices of Centennial in a building called the Stonehouse. We'll be talking about that again in weeks to come. Now, one of the major items that we've been looking at on One Step Beyond in recent months has been the drug thug Len Vest case. This basically is an apparently CIA and Contra-related drug smuggling case in the spring of 1988. A barge full of marijuana and hashish was busted out in San Francisco Bay. This, in turn, unraveled an alleged and apparent CIA drug smuggling operation, which was, in turn, very closely connected to the Contra support efforts. The main elements involved, and I'm going to go over this very quickly, the main elements involved are two fellows named Dr. John Duff and Kenneth Armitage, who in turn owns or controlled something called the Drug Island. Now, the Drug Island, or Isla Jesucita, was an island off the coast of Costa Rica that was used as a transshipment point for arms and drugs to be used to support the Contra war. The island was under the stewardship of General Noriega of Panama, one of the major players in the drug thug case. The two people who owned the island for Noriega, or who owned it nominally for Noriega, were Dr. John Duff and Kenneth Armitage. Kenneth Armitage died mysteriously in jail in Britain when he threatened to roll over in the case. Dr. John Duff, in turn, was a business partner of John Hull and apparently lived on his ranch in Costa Rica for some time. John Hull has been implicated in a number of different investigations of the Contra support effort and drug smuggling therein, both by the Costa Rican government, the Christic Institute, and the Kerry Subcommittee. John Hull also a key player in the drug thug case, according to the information at least presented by Harry Martin. Dr. John Duff, interestingly enough, also a business partner of Howard Lonsdale, a fellow who rented the Aryan Nations the property for their little abortive Aryan Woodstock in the spring of 1989. Now, in turn, Calvin Robinson, the skipper of the drug tug, claims to have worked for the CIA. He, in turn, has connections to not only the Medellin cartel, which also figures prominently in the drug tug case, as well as the Contra support effort, but also to three fellows, Thurston, Russell, and Wobser, two of whom had connections to Air America, and Thurston as well to another CIA air proprietary, Amer West Incorporated. It's worth noting, too, that Charles Duck, The bank. Oh, no, by the way, Calvin Robinson claimed that his whole operation, the skipper of the drug tug, claimed his whole operation was CIA all along. He also has some interesting connections to Christopher Boyce of the Falcon and the convicted spy in the Falcon and Snowman case, and that in turn has some interesting possible CIA connections as well, possible CIA double agent connections as well. Again, the drug tug series, we went into all of these connections in some detail. Now, one of the main names that we're going to want to bear in mind for our present, the purposes of our present discussion, is Charles Duck. He was the bankruptcy trustee for LendVest, the LendVest mortgage company, one of the major business institutions connected with the financial end of the drug tug operations. Now, interestingly enough, Charles Duck's, the heir of the flight manifest for one of his trips to Costa Rica was subpoenaed by a congressional subcommittee. His attorney, Charles Duck's attorney, is Peter Robinson. Now, Peter Robinson was the assistant U.S. attorney that we looked at in connection with the investigation, or perhaps alleged investigation would be a better word, of the Centennial Savings and Loan. Recall also in this series we took a look at Joseph Russinello, the person under whom Peter Robinson worked, and Joseph Russinello's charges that the Latin community in the Bay Area insulates drug traffickers from law enforcement, an ironic statement for him to have made, inasmuch as he was responsible for returning some money to the Contras that was taken from a major cocaine smuggling case that broke here in the Bay Area. And again, we looked at that in an article earlier in the series. Now, Peter Robinson, who worked under Joseph Russinello, did not wait the requisite period of time after his formal retirement as assistant U.S. attorney before going to work representing Charles Duck. In addition to Charles Duck, Peter Robinson also represents another LendVest officer, David Dixon. He also, according to the information that we reviewed last week, represents Alvaro Barcera, another fellow who is a member of the Medellin cartel, another key player in this whole tangle of events and the Contra support effort that we have been looking at. And we're going to review once again part four of the drug tug case next week by way of developing these connections further. But it's worth noting here, again, the relationship between Peter Robinson and Centennial, allegedly investigating Centennial, then he drops the Centennial investigation and retires as soon as Irv Hansen's death brings a premature end to that investigation. He moves into Centennial's former offices in the Stonehouse, and he goes to work representing, among others, Charles Duck illegally because he had not waited the requisite period of time before going to work representing someone who his office had been investigating. Now, reviewing the relationship between Peter Robinson and Charles Duck, and in turn highlighting the relationship between Charles Duck and Centennial Savings and Loan, we're going to review some information from an article from the Napa Sentinel from November 7th of 1989. And again, this is by the Napa Sentinel's editor, Harry Martin, who's the fellow who's been breaking the drug tug case. And this particular article is headlined, Fooling Them, subheaded, The Elusive DuckTales Continue. It reads in part as follows. Duck, that's Charles Duck. Duck took over LendVest and prevented it from being declared fully insolvent. He and his attorney racked up high fees while economic solutions for the victims of the LendVest were carefully skirted. The pattern of many other cases resembled the same technique Duck applied to LendVest, from commingling of funds to direct conflicts of interest to strange bank loans and services from Redwood Bank. The U.S. Attorney's Office in San Francisco and Santa Rosa, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and the Criminal Investigation Service of the Internal Revenue Service were all asked to investigate Duck as early as August 20, 1986. Peter Robinson, an assistant U.S. attorney, was included in the request for an investigation of Duck. Robinson is now Duck's attorney. Under federal law, a former U.S. government attorney cannot represent a client who was part of an investigation of that office for at least 2 years after the attorney has left government service. Robinson has not been out of government service for 2 years yet. Robinson also represents David Dixon, a former LendVest officer. At the time the investigation on Duck was requested, three main concerns were expressed. Note these closely. The appointment of Duck as trustee to property involved in legal action between Centennial Savings and Loan and property known as Wild Oak, the property owned by Duck at Wild Oak, loans to Duck from Redwood Bank. When Duck was appointed as trustee for Wild Oak, objections were expressed because it appeared Duck was in conflict of interest owning property in the Wild Oak Village. A federal judge ignored the complaint of conflict and appointed Duck as trustee. Duck owned three parcels at Wild Oak Village. So again, one of the things that the U.S. Attorney's Office was asked to investigate, the appointment of Charles Duck as trustee to property involved in legal action between Centennial Savings and Loan and property known as Wild Oak. So we now see Charles Duck involved with Centennial as well. Bear in mind, Centennial again, the baby of Irv Hansen and Sid Shaw. We'll look at Shaw next week and in weeks to come. Hansen's death basically brings an end to the Centennial Savings and Loan investigation. The assistant U.S. attorney allegedly investigating that, Peter Robinson, then moves into Centennial's former headquarters and begins representing Charles Duck illegally, apparently. And Charles Duck, one of the players in the tangle surrounding Centennial Savings and Loan, whose growth was fueled by broker deposits from Mario Renda, the same Mario Renda we took a look at in connection with the failure of the Indian Springs State Bank and Global International Airways, the same Mario Renda who connects up also to the Empire State Savings Bank, the Empire Savings Bank that we looked at in its failure, in turn hooked up with Wordy Jack Thompson of Buffalo Airways, the incorporator of Buffalo Airways, the incorporator of Global Jet Sales, which in turn intersects with Global, Ransom, Response Air, etc., the sort of CIA air proprietary daisy chain that we looked at in the first article in tonight's broadcast. Now, we're going to, again, if some of these connections seem a little bit abbreviated, we're going to be coming back to these in weeks to come. But bear in mind the Peter Robinson connection to the investigation of Centennial, the Mario Renda connection to Centennial, the Charles Duck connection to Centennial. Bear in mind the curious behavior of Joseph Russoniello by vis-a-vis returning money to the Contras that had been obtained apparently from cocaine trafficking. We're going to come back to all of that to a certain extent next week. One of the things we looked at in the last installment of this broadcast was a tantalizing little item dropped in the Napa Sentinel by Harry Martin, in which it talked about Congressman Bosco, who represents the Napa area, and he apparently was one of the congressmen to raise the strongest objections and attempt to obstruct the investigation into the savings and loan failures and the scandal surrounding those failures. And we're going to take a look at Doug Bosco, his attempts to frustrate the congressional S&L investigation, and we're also going to take a look at Bosco's connections to the Centennial Savings and Loan. Returning once again to the book Inside Job by Pizzo, Fricker, and Muolo. Of the relationship between Centennial Savings and Loan and Doug Bosco, they write as follows. Irv Hansen was building Centennial into a center of financial power in Northern California. And skipping down after talking about some of Hansen's media purchases, but Hansen was interested in buying more than good press. Success and money always attract politicians, and Centennial attracted its share. Congressman Doug Bosco, a Democrat, came from a small town near Guerneville where he had been a Haynes family friend. That's Beverly Haynes, another officer of Centennial. We'll talk about her next week. That's that last sentence again. Congressman Douglas Bosco, a Democrat, came from a small town near Guerneville where he had been a Haynes family friend. A born politician, he was an attorney and a former member of the California State Legislature, where he was a member of the Assembly Finance, Insurance, and Commerce Committee. Centennial was quick to lavish attention on Bosco. Bosco's mother was given a job working for Haynes at Centennial, and Shaw, that's Sid Shaw, hired a friend of Bosco's to manage Shaw's company, Lakewood Enterprises. Hansen, Shaw, Haynes, and various family members were listed as contributors to Bosco on his 1983 and 1984 disclosure statements. In addition, Bosco borrowed $124,000 from Centennial and $65,000 from Golden Pacific between 1982 and 1984. His payments were often late, and a thrift executive told us S&L officers had to call Bosco in Washington to discuss bringing his payments current. Bosco said the tardiness was caused by frequent moves. In 1984, Bosco used Centennial's private plane to attend the funeral of a constituent and failed to report it on his federal financial disclosure form. He said the failure was an oversight. In 1986, he was questioned by the FBI about Centennial savings, but he was not accused of any wrongdoing. An FBI agent told us that if the FBI investigated Bosco for his relationship with Centennial, they'd have to investigate all congressmen because they all did the same thing. Bosco said his relationship with Centennial was completely above board, that he never asked them for any personal favors, nor did they ever do him any. But with powerful friends, Centennial Savings' influence in the community prospered nicely. And although Bosco claims never to have used his influence on behalf of Centennial, that may not be an entirely candid statement. It's worth noting that the aforementioned Piombo Corporation sale, that was basically what put the investigators, what put Mr. Pizzo onto the connection between the Bureau of Indian Affairs and Mario Renda and Centennial, and Mario Renda's role in brokering the deposits which built up Centennial. It was basically the Piombo case which put federal regulators on the Centennial and which brought it down. And when federal regulators began to focus in on Centennial, Douglas Bosco, the same Doug Bosco who was heavily involved in a number of ways with Centennial, including borrowing money from it, well, he raised quite a stink. The authors write about that as follows in Inside Job. The Piombo sale was the final outrage. At 5 p.m. on August 20, 1985, a small army of FSLIC examiners, auditors, and private security guards stormed Centennial's branches. A representative of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board walked up to Hansen, handed him a letter from Washington, and said, "Mr. Hansen, we are declaring Centennial insolvent. You are hereby removed as chairman of the board and president. Please give us your keys and do not touch anything on or in your desk," unquote. If there was ever a moment to call in one's IOUs, that was it. And that night, Centennial's favorite congressman, Doug Bosco, announced from his home in Washington, D.C. that he was outraged by the bank board's action. He said that he was concerned for Centennial's shareholders and that he knew Hansen and considered him to be a kind, generous, and humanitarian man. He said he was going to personally investigate the bank board's seizure of Centennial. Bosco was just one of the first in a long line of congressmen and senators who would interfere with the regulatory process in the name of constituent service. Bosco was later forced to make an embarrassing public retraction when a group of conservative bankers threatened to withdraw their financial support for Bosco if he did not distance himself from the likes of Irv Hansen. A spokesman explained their reasoning. "My feeling is that a legislator should have all the facts before criticizing federal regulators. Centennial was a high-flying organization that was headed for trouble for a long time." So again, we see Doug Bosco going to bat for Centennial, trying to frustrate the congressional investigation into the Centennial savings and loans, and that's maybe not all that surprising since he hooks up with Centennial. He had a number of friends and associates who were cooperating with various people and worked with some of the people involved in Centennial. And last but most assuredly not least, he borrowed a lot of money from Centennial himself. Now, one of the things that we looked at in connection with the Drug Tug case, we reviewed it in our last installment, is the fact that Doug Bosco also was one of the 17 signatories to the letter basically pressuring President Oscar Arias of Costa Rica to grant John Hull rather lenient treatment. It was not in so many words, but that was the clear implication of the letter, and it implied that perhaps failure to do so might damage Costa Rican-U.S. relations. It remains to be seen just what motivated Congressman Bosco to do that, but one of the questions that this particular observer has anyway is whether or not Bosco's pressure on Arias on behalf of Hull had anything to do with the Drug Tug case, which obviously unraveled in his particular district, and in turn, one wonders in light of the fact that there are obviously some common elements to the Contra support effort, the Christic Institute and Kerry investigations, and the Drug Tug case, and in turn, the intersection between many of the elements cropping up in the Christic Institute and Kerry investigations, as well as the Costa Rican official investigation, many of those same elements crop up in the background of the CIA SNL connection as well. So what relationship exists between the CIA SNL connection, the Drug Tug case, Congressman Bosco's attempts to frustrate the investigations into the Centennial savings and loan, and his pressure on President Arias of Costa Rica on behalf of John Hull? What relationship, if any, exists between those is, I guess you could say, food for thought and grounds for further research. It certainly is a major question in this observer's mind, and it is going to be a subject that we are going to be exploring in weeks to come, and that Harry Martin has begun to explore in a terrific series in the Napa Sentinel that we will be taking up next week and in weeks to come. It looks like we will have a little bit of time for phone calls. I'm going to review briefly what we've looked at in the course of tonight's broadcast, and again, I want to emphasize that, to my mind, one of the major points of understanding is also one of the major potential points of confusion in this case, and that is the dizzying tangle of names and institutions and the circular relationships and the maze of interconnecting relationships between many of these persons and institutions. Now, we began by taking a look at an article from the Houston Post of February 8th of 1990, again about Farhad Azeem and Global International Airways, looking at the relationship between Global International and a number of different airlines and aircraft parts companies, Response Air, Ransom Air, Buffalo Airways, also owned by Azeem, Global Jet Sales, incorporated by Wordy Jack Thompson, the same person who incorporated Buffalo Airways. We took a look at the fact that Global was headed by Ransom Air, by Mr. Ransom, the same fellow who headed Ransom Air. We took a look at Wordy Jack Thompson's connections to the failure of the Empire, savings and loan. And in turn, Mario Renda, the same Mario Renda from the Centennial Savings and Loan, was connected to the Empire Savings and Loan. Recall that Global International helped bring down the Sunshine, or not the Sunshine, but the Sun Belt. Sunshine State Bank was a couple of weeks ago with Corona. The Sun Belt Savings and Loan, one of the major names connected with Sun Belt Savings and Loan, is Herman K. Beebe. Recall also we took a look at Morris Jaffe, his relationship to Carlos Marcello, and his relationship to Jim Wright, former House Speaker Jim Wright. That helped bring down House Speaker Jim Wright, but apparently some of these relationships have not as yet brought down the Republican politicians who intersect with them, only the Democrats so far. After that, we took a look at William LeMaster, the fellow who appointed Anthony Russo, an organized crime figure who intersects both with the Indian Springs State Bank and Global International Airlines. Well, basically, he put both Farhad Azeem and Russo of Global on the board of directors of Indian Springs State Bank. Indian Springs State Bank then goes down in part as a result of its relationship to Global. We then took a look at the fiery and mysterious death of William LeMaster when the case began to break open. After that, we took a look at the names of Charles Keating, Silverado Savings and Loan, the MDC Holdings Company, and Southmark, a very important connection which links Charles Keating, currently being connected with, and properly so, with Alan Cranston. Charles Keating also intersects with a number of Republicans and right-wing elements that have not as yet been tarred by that same association as Cranston has. The Southmark Company, a key element uniting this tangle of events that we're looking at this evening. Southmark involves Herman K. Beebe to a large extent, the same Herman K. Beebe we took a look at in connection with the failure of the Sunbelt Savings and Loan. Southmark helps lend money to MDC. MDC's operations inextricable with those of the Silverado Savings and Loan, one of the major failed savings and loans apparently connected to elements of CIA. The main name there is Neil Bush. We then took a look at the Southmark Corporation, Gene Phillips, its head, its relationship with Herman K. Beebe, its relationship with Drexel Burnham Lambert, Charles Keating, Michael Milken, the junk bond industry, as well as the Silverado Savings and Loan. Bear in mind, too, we took a look at the San Jacinto Savings Bank, which was heavily involved with MDC, MDC Holdings, and Larry Mizell, its chairman, two of the key elements involved with Neil Bush and company in the Silverado Savings and Loan. We took a look, too, at the relationship between the Southmark organization and some of the Iran-Contra crowd, and specifically took a look at the name of General John Singlaub, who apparently was involved in some respect with some of the people in the Southmark operation. We then took a look at the March 11th, 1990 article from the Houston Post and Pete Bruton about the failure of the Silverado Savings and Loan Institution. The main names here, again, the aforementioned Herman Beebe, the aforementioned Neil Bush. We took a look at Southmark, and specifically San Jacinto. We took a look at people named Larry Mizell, Bill Walters, Kenneth Good, and Norman Brownstein. All of those people, in turn, intersect with Herman K. Beebe, Frank Corson, a reputed CIA operative, Wayne Reeder, a reputed CIA operative. And again, the exact nature of all of those relationships takes too long to spell out. It took long enough just to read. We then took a look at an article from the Houston Post of February 4th of 1990, this dealing with Frank Corson, one of the alleged CIA operatives who intersects with many of the key players in the failure of the Silverado Savings and Loan. We then took a look at another one of the CIA connections to the Silverado Savings and Loan, Wayne Reeder, and his abortive plan to build weapons on an Indian reservation and sell them to the Contras. We also took a look at Reeder's connections to Southmark Corporation. Specifically, he ran Carlsberg Management, a Southmark subsidiary. We also took a look at Reeder's connections to the failure of the San Marino Savings Bank. That's where the authors of the book Inside Job came across him. Now, the failure of the San Marino SPAC was in part due to the operations and the machinations of Mario Renda, the same Mario Renda we looked at in connection with the Global International and the Indian Springs State failure, the same Mario Renda who figures in connection with the Empire Savings failure, which in turn hooks up with Wordy Jack Thompson, Buffalo Airways, etc. And Mario Renda, also a key player in the failure of the Centennial Savings and Loan. He was one of the people who helped fuel Centennial's enormous growth with his brokered deposits using money basically scammed from the Bureau of Indian Affairs and Native Americans. We took a look at Renda and Centennial, and then took a look at Irv Hansen, the main figure involved with the Centennial Savings and Loan. We took a look at how his death frustrated the investigation into the Centennial Savings and Loan. We took a look at how Assistant U.S. Attorney Peter Robinson, allegedly in charge with investigating the failure of the Centennial Savings and Loan, then promptly went from prosecuting cases like that to defending many of the same people he had formerly allegedly prosecuted, and perhaps appropriately, he moved into the former headquarters of the Centennial Savings and Loan in the Stone House. We then took a look at his relationship with Charles Duck, the bankruptcy trustee for the LendVest company. We also took a look briefly at his relationship with another LendVest officer, David Dixon, and alluded to his representing Alvaro Barcera of the Medellin cartel, another player in the Contra support effort, Iran-Contra scandal, as well as the drug tug case. And again, bear in mind, we also took a look at Charles Duck and his connections to the Centennial Savings and Loan, this bringing us back again to the drug tug case, and we're going to explore that in weeks to come. We also took a look at Congressman Bosco, the money he borrowed from Centennial, and the way in which Congressman Bosco was putting pressure on Congress and the appropriate regulatory authorities to basically to cool it on Centennial Savings and Loan, to take the heat off of Centennial Savings and Loan. And we speculated about what possible connection might exist between Bosco, the drug tug case, the Centennial Savings and Loan, his attempts to reduce pressure on Centennial Savings and Loan, and his apparent attempts to reduce pressure on John Hull, who figures in the background of drug tug, as well as many of the other cases we've looked at. That's what we looked at this evening, and again, I apologize if some of this has seemed overly confusing. Obviously, I made a couple of small factual errors, which I was able to correct since I always proceed from the actual text here. But it's a dizzying tangle of events, and again, at the risk of perhaps being a little too repetitive, one of the major potential points of confusion, the dizzying array of names and institutions at the same time, when viewed from a certain perspective, also becomes one of the major points of understanding. There is no way all of these people and all of these institutions could connect up in all of these ways with all of these different S&L failures unless it was part of a concerted, organized effort. This is far, far too much to attribute to coincidence.